appeals, and we have two cases set for the afternoon docket. The first is People against Samuels, and the second is Clark against People. I see that counsel are set up in the first case, so we have experienced counsel before us. We may begin. Mr. Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon to you all. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Rosen, attorney registration 23372, appearing on behalf of Mr. Samuels, who does not appear today. There are numerous issues that were raised in the briefs. I'm not going to try to get to all of them today. I don't feel that's practical. I'm going to try and focus on three issues if I can get to all three today with any luck. First, of course, will be the issue concerning the right to conflict-free counsel. In this matter, I'd state to the court that it's fairly clear that the trial court dropped the ball and analyzed whether or not there's a conflict of interest under the wrong rules. The court chose to go forward under Rule 1.9 in a Frisco analysis instead of a 1.7 in a Rodriguez analysis. I'd submit to the court that that's pretty clearly error in this case. And as such, the trial court never got to the issue of whether or not the conflict could be waived, and never went through the process of obtaining a valid waiver from the from Mr. Samuels before allowing Mr. Samuels to go forward with the representation of the Office of State Public Defender. And I'd state to the court that under Edibles, that's a reversible error. It's automatic at this point. And I really don't see much of a way around that at this point for the AG's office, or and I may be oversimplifying it. And if
Mr. Rosen?
Yes, sir.
What's the conflict?
The conflict is the fact that Mr. Walsh represented Mr. Strickland. Mr. Strickland was the state's witness in the case. Mr. Walsh represented him not only in the case where Strickland sought leniency in exchange for his testimony, but on several prior occasions as well.
Isn't it clear under the record, though, that the attorney did not represent Mr. Strickland in any plea negotiations relating to this case, and in fact withdrew before there was any indication that Mr. Strickland was even a potential witness in this case?
No, actually, I'd argue against that.
Where in the record does it say that?
I don't have the record site in front of me at this point, but I would state to the court that I believe he withdrew after the only reason why he withdrew from representing Mr. Strickland was because it was brought to his attention that Mr. Strickland was going to be a witness against Mr. Samuels. There's no other reason in the record why he withdrew.
Actually, I think the record indicates he was going to be a witness against some other people in other cases.
That's correct.
I didn't see anything in the record that indicated he was going to be a witness against this defendant. And in fact, I saw nothing in the record that indicated that the people even attempted to refute counsel's allegation that he had no knowledge at all that there was a potential that Mr. Strickland would be a witness against this defendant.
Even assuming that's correct, it's the fact that there's an attorney-client relationship that occurred between Mr. Walsh and Mr. Strickland that creates a conflict. It's the adversity of interest under Rule 1.7, which was recently reaffirmed in the Shari decision. In People v. Shari, the Supreme Court just months ago stated that where an individual defense attorney has previously represented or is currently representing a prosecution witness involved in the case against the defendant, there is a direct conflict of interest. So even if this court's point is well-founded, the very fact that there's an attorney relationship between Walsh and Strickland creates that adversity of interest under Rule 1.7. This is exactly the analysis that occurred in Rodriguez. Did I answer the court's question satisfactorily?
Yes.
Thank you. Assuming that the court does find, in fact, that there's a conflict, the fact that there's a Chinese wall is, of course, irrelevant. It is a 1.10 imputation of conflict that's the problem. That was not changed in Shari. Shari, of course, looked at whether or not the Office of the State Public Defender should be disqualified under Rule 1.11. But that was primarily and solely because the parties argued that to the court, and the court adopted that as a position. As Justice Coates points out in his dissent, he spends several paragraphs talking about the unwarranted and unwise nature of that position, and I would adopt those arguments here today. And of course, if there is in fact a conflict, there has to be a waiver by the client. And in this case, there is simply a head nod for Mr. Samuels during what is somewhat of a long, convoluted explanation between counsel and the court on this issue that they ended up getting wrong at the tail end of all this. It's hard to imagine that that would satisfy the colloquy necessary under Edibles and would satisfy the court's duties to extract, to first lay an admonition on the record concerning the nature of the conflict and setting that forth for the client and then extracting a valid waiver on the record. And this is, of course, ignoring the fact that there was no written waiver, which is required under Rule 1.7. So I'd state to the court that there are several reasons why any purported waiver in this case would be ineffective. I'll move along.
Mr. Rosen,
yes, sir.
Let me just clarify. I did not see an argument in your brief in the alternative that, assuming 1.9 applies, the court's analysis under 1.9 was erroneous. Is that correct? You're simply arguing that 1.7 rather than 1.9 applies, and that under 1.7 there was a conflict that was not waived.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that was actually my position, and that's because the nature of the two rules and interrelationship of them. And the way I picture it is, if you're looking at a dartboard, the entire board is Rule 1.7, and that is a conflict of interest. The next concentric circle in would be whether or not it's waivable under 1.7. The next one in would be whether or not the defendant actually waived it. And then the smallest little bullseye right in the middle would be 1.9, whether or not the prior client's rights to confidentiality in the communications with the attorney should be used to trump the fact that there is this giant conflict of interest, but it's being waived, and that the client would like to go forward with the choice of attorney at that point. It's a very small subset, and whether or not it's correctly applied is completely irrelevant to the larger dartboard of 1.7. If there are no more questions on that issue, I'd like to move forward onto the Fourth Amendment violation, which I actually find to be legally extremely interesting. It's based, in my humble opinion, on a complete misreading of Knights, both the state's current position and the trial court's ruling at the trial court level, that a probationer, just by the virtue of the fact that they're on probation, have a diminished expectation of privacy in their house. To the extent that a warrant is not necessary and mere reasonable suspicion can allow an intrusion by the government into that house. And in my humble opinion, that's a complete misreading of Knights. Knights didn't say anything like that. Knights said that it was a specific term of condition which notified and gave notice to the defendant in that case that his expectations of privacy that were diminished. That's what allowed the lesser standard in that case. And I guess it's really not just my humble opinion. It's also the, not so humble opinion of the Georgia Supreme Court in the Jones decision, the Tennessee court in the Howell opinion, the Pennsylvania court in the Pickeron decision, and the Flag court out of Illinois. I just see no legitimate reading of Knights that says by virtue of the fact that somebody is on probation, they're stripped of their Fourth Amendment protections inside their house. And I think the analysis would have been very different under McCullough if it had been a parole situation. And I think the AG's office was misguided, but at least that has some applicability if there's a parole situation. Because for parole clients, there's actually a law that says there should be a search condition as part of your parole. And it's part of the standard terms and conditions of parole. They put it in there for the parolees to sign off on. That's what McCullough said. And that's what made for a valid search under McCullough. But this is probation. There's no term in the terms of probation that allows the search. There's no law that says that this should be authorized. It's a very different circumstance. And I just don't see how we can stretch a blanket over all probationers at this point in time and lump them together. The misdemeanants, the felons, the municipal level people, everybody who's on probation has lost their Fourth Amendment right to have a warrant issued before their house is searched. Seems to be a bad fit, I would argue, to the court. Lastly, I'm going to try and hit the what I also think is an incredibly interesting legal issue, and that's the challenge for cause, where there's evidence of bias on the fact that the juror actually says, you know, the fact that he has a felony conviction, it makes him more likely that he committed the murder. That's a pretty good indication of bias. And rehabilitation on it was you could probably stretch it to equivocal, but I don't think it gets much beyond that. The trial judge didn't talk to the juror or the jury panel about a situation where the defendant does not testify and there's evidence of the felony conviction. The trial judge simply talks to the jury panel about the fact, if he testifies, you can use it towards his credibility. But there's nothing in there that talks about, if he doesn't testify, how do you get to use it against the defendant? And the juror even points this out to the trial court. The jury, when the judge addresses the juror, the first thing the juror starts talking back to the judge about, we talk about a witness or the defendant. And the court says, witnesses, if they testify under oath, this is what you do. So you have a pretty clear indication of bias and a lousy job of rehabilitation, if I may say. And then defense counsel doesn't strike him. And defense counsel has peremptories left, which to me is crazy. But ultimately, the issue is whether or not there is a biased juror that sat on the panel. The issue is not whether or not defense attorney was crazy or wrong or slothful or misguided or whatever word you'd like to tack on to that. The issue is whether or not a defendant who is now serving life plus 150 years had a fair jury. And I'd submit to the court that they didn't. And I would reserve the remainder of my time that's left for reply.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Kaler.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. My registration number is 19210. I'm here for the people. I'll give the short answer responses to most of our arguments. If the court wants to call me on anything, please come after me, as I know the court has done it many times in the past. Concerning the conflict issue, the short answer here is it was the prosecution that was trying to get defense counsel knocked off. The defendant was the party who wanted counsel there. The defendant got what he wanted over the prosecution's objection. What the defendant is doing here is raising a claim that if the prosecution wanted to challenge its guilty verdicts, be something the prosecution should bring as under notice of appeal. Because the defendant got what he wanted here, he stuck with that choice.
Mr. Kaler,
yes, Your Honor.
I've got a problem with that. I know that's your invited error argument, but if the very counsel who argued against the conflict, in fact, had a conflict, how could that counsel bind the defendant to a position and therefore preclude the defendant from taking a different position on appeal?
Because the trial court checked with the defendant himself, and the defendant was there, he listened to the colloquy, and the trial court checked with the defendant to make sure that this was true.
So your position is the nod of the head is a waiver of any conflict?
Correct, Your Honor.
Just the nod of the head.
Okay. That doesn't begin to comport with the requirements of waiver as set forth in Edibles, does it?
Well, Edibles was a situation where the conflict, where there was actually, counsel actually had a conflict because counsel had been charged by the prosecution in that particular district and was facing criminal charges. Therefore, counsel actually had a reason to go easy on the prosecution's case because he was theoretically facing blowback on his own criminal charges. Here, I don't even think there was a conflict. Counsel had gotten off representation on the prior client. He had screened off his case file from other people in his office. Co-counsel did the cross-examination. There was a discovery motion so that the contents of his case file could be recreated for cross-examination. And there was a full active cross-examination here. There was just no conflict here at all, Your Honor. So, yeah.
So does your waiver argument ultimately come down to that there is no conflict?
Well, no, because the defendant affirmed this is what he wanted to do, and it was discussed in his presence, and the defendant affirmed this is what he wanted to do, he's stuck. And if the defendant had not said, I'm sure the trial court, well, it's likely the trial court would have granted the prosecution's motion and gotten new counsel. But going on, there was no conflict less because the defendant was getting what he needed, and his representation was not adversely affected by his counsel's prior representation of the prosecution witness in an unrelated case. The suppression motion, I think the language in Knights is very broad. The question is not based on, the Supreme Court was not addressing particular probation rules or anything like that. It was addressing the grand issue of what expectation of privacy do probationers have that society is willing to recognize as reasonable.
But in Knights, one of the factors the court looked to determine the reasonableness of the expectation of privacy was, in fact, the condition of parole, or excuse me, of probation. So, I mean, it's clear throughout the opinion that that was one of the factors the court was relying on.
In fact, doesn't the court characterize that as a salient factor?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I read the opinion, Your Honor, as very broad, not depending on the nature of the particular probation contract the defendant signed. That the issue was addressed as what expectation of privacy did the defendant have as a probationer, and because of his former status and the need to encourage his rehabilitation and to protect society from further problems, that he had a substantially diminished expectation of privacy.
Is it the state's position that the probation officer needed some cause, some reasonable suspicion, or is it the state's position that merely by virtue of the defendant's status as a probationer, no such suspicion or cause was required?
Well, if there had been our position here is that based on the facts of this particular case is that because the arrest warrant had been issued and because that gave the probation officer at least reasonable suspicion, that's all that the probation officer needed in order to conduct a search here.
I understand that your position on that. I'm just trying to ascertain the principle here to determine to what degree does the state contend this particular probationer's reasonable expectation of privacy was diminished. Was it diminished all the way to zero, as was the case in Sampson with the parolee where there was a condition?
No, I think if there were explicit conditions as occur with parolees, he would have no expectation. But because of the nature of the expectation of privacy as set forth in Knights, all that the probation officer needed to conduct a search here was reasonable suspicion. And by virtue of the arrest warrant, the probation officer had that. The challenge for cause issue, I think Dunlap and the other cases cited in our brief are fairly clear that when a defendant wants to challenge or wants to object on appeal to the denial of a challenge for cause, he must exhaust his peremptory challenges. And here the defendant had available ones left, and therefore the issue is just not available for appellate review. And there was some question whether counsel was ineffective or not exhausting. Well, the question is, as also set forth in Dunlap 2, a death penalty case where counsel did not exhaust their peremptory challenges, they thought they had a good enough panel as it was. They didn't need to burn up peremptory challenges in a vain attempt that might actually subject the defendant to a worse jury panel from which to select the final jurors, because when you get rid of someone, you don't necessarily come up with someone who is even more acceptable than what you are. The persons that would move into the jury panel could be substantially worse for the defendant, and defense counsel's able to make that decision on his own without being subjected to second guessing later on. That's all I really have to say. If the court has any questions on any other matters, the time limits on jury selection or the various evidentiary things, I could address those, but I think those are fairly standard abuse of discretion issues for which the trial court had good grounds to make its ruling.
Mr. Kaler,
yes,
on the biased juror issue, are you asking us to go where the Supreme Court has not yet tread? That is, in Dunlap, the court refused to decide whether it was necessary to preempt or to use all peremptory challenges in situations where the juror actually sat on the jury. Left open that question, which is the situation we have here. Are you asking us to hold as a matter of law that unless all peremptory challenges are used, then the claim simply can't be raised on appeal? And if so, what's your legal authority for that? Certainly there isn't any Colorado authority on that.
No, I think it's a matter of deference to the decisions that defense counsel make. They can look at somebody on the appellate record that may be, have troubles, may look troublesome from the point of view of us reading words on paper later on. But by looking at defense counsel's view at the time, as I previously mentioned, they're faced with a limited choice of jurors to get on the thing. They make hard choices as far as who is going to get on the jury panel. And by getting rid of making choices, you can let between somebody that says words that may be problematical on a page, then you could have somebody else later on who says all the right ones, but defense counsel can look at that person and say, well, he would be a disaster because he's looking daggers at me. I don't want, even though he said all the right magic words, I don't want that person on the jury panel. So to make sure that the defendant is not crying wolf within a claim on appeal, what defense counsel down below has to say is, I am serious about this challenge for cause. I am so serious that I'm willing to use up a peremptory challenge on this particular prospective juror to keep him or her off the jury panel. And here, defense counsel had available peremptory challenges to show us that was a serious challenge below and not a challenge just made for the purposes of appeal. So comes back again to the fact that this is another issue where the defense counsel gets to make the choice down below. And if it's a serious claim, defense counsel down below has to treat it as a serious claim by using an available peremptory challenge. I have nothing further. Any other questions from the court? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The defendant got what he wanted, and now he is stuck, was the argument of the Attorney General. I don't believe that's the legal standard for a determination of whether or not there's been an adequate waiver of the right to conflict-free counsel. I believe the law is that it needs to be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary decision on the part of the defendant. That requires certain things: adequate information, the capacity to understand, accurate legal advice instead of being misinformed on the law by counsel. It requires these things. In Montour, the court said the record was awash with evidence of waiver, but because it was based on misunderstandings of the law, it wasn't a valid waiver. The fact that Mr. Samuels may have indicated with a head nod that he wanted to keep Mr. Walsh and or Mr. Stahivish on as his counsel is hardly satisfactory evidence underneath the legal standards. As for the biased juror issue, yes, I am asking you to go where the Supreme Court has not yet tread. I am hoping that you will, and that you'll come down on our side of the argument on that, and I think it's well-founded. If you look at McCrander and the reason why there's an automatic reversal rule in situations where peremptory challenges have been exhausted, and that's the body of law which esteemed counsel was referring to, if you use the same rationale for this body of law, which is different, this is protecting the right to a fair trial, not the peremptories, the reasoning behind McCrander is we presume that there was prejudice when counsel has used up all the peremptories, and we don't require proof of actual prejudice because that's too high a standard. That's too much. We've gotten there. We have shown actual bias. We have done what was impossible, or at least not required, under McCrander. To say under McCrander we're going to presume prejudice and have an automatic reversal rule, but in situations where we actually show prejudice, we're not going to have an automatic reversal rule. It's kind of crazy. And I'd submit to the court that that's a much better way to proceed.
No, Mr. Rosen.
Yes, sir.
Unless there's a requirement that the defendant exhaust peremptory challenges, isn't there a real danger that the defendant can sandbag the issue? Lost a challenge for cause, not use up peremptories and say, hey, I've got a winner on appeal, I'm not gonna excuse this juror.
And this is a fundamental issue that I have on a personal level. I honestly think trial judges should be smarter than defense counsel. I think holding them to the standard of knowing the law and making correct decisions is not such a bad thing. The AG's arguments that I hear over and over again, it's all defense counsel. It's all up to them, and the court has no burden. The court has no obligation to know the law. And if the court gets it wrong, that's okay, because defense counsel didn't catch it either, which lowers the level of the bar for judges down to the level of defense counsel. I'd state to the court, that is not sound policy. Unless there are further questions, I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Mr. Samuels appreciates your time.
Court again thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will be deemed submitted and the written opinion will issue in due course. We will now take up the case of Clark against the people. Counsel may set up.